I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Robert Farley, and you have found the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is the second half of a podcast that myself and Dan Nixon recorded last week, which was supposed to touch on topics of Russia and Russian policy in the United States, but also on questions of the hegemonic order that the United States has established and that the United States is in some sense attempting to maintain, although much of that has changed under the Trump administration. Dan is working on a book with Alex Cooley on this very subject, and in fact has already produced three lengthy, detailed blog posts about this question of international order, of international hegemony, and of the role of U.S. foreign policy, especially under the Trump administration, in the maintenance of this hegemonic order. And so without further ado, I'm going to let Dan just talk a little bit about what this project is intended to do, where he's attempting to go with it, and what he thinks will result from it. And so then we'll talk a little bit more about some of the nuts and bolts about of American hegemony, and especially of shifts between different hegemonic orders. So Dan, without further ado, why don't you get us started on this relationship between the Donald and hegemony?
So one of the things that Alex Cooley and I are trying to do in this book is to argue that, and I've mentioned this, that there's a lot of talk right now about the Thucydides trap. I don't know if that's a term that many of our listeners would be familiar with. It's all over the policy community. And this is Graham Allison essentially reinventing the wheel on what's called power transition theory and hegemonic stability theory. So if you know, the founding people in the post-war, it's Gilpin, it's Argansky, it's Kugler, it's people like that. And there's, in fact, an argument within the academic community that Allison is really not been clear about the degree that he is just riffing on their arguments. But that's what academics like to argue about. So the Thucydides trap argument says that essentially we're going through a power transition, and the big question is, are we going to be able to avoid a war with China? And how do we avoid a war with China? And how do the U.S. and the Chinese avoid a war with one another? And that's very emblematic of power transition theory, that says that what really matters is you have the dominant actor that goes into decline, and you have the rising challenger who may turn increasingly hostile if it doesn't get what it wants in the international order. And if we don't adjust to this successfully, there will be a great power war. And what Alex and I are trying to argue is that there's an enormous amount, and this is something that academics are really starting to focus on, thankfully, there's an enormous amount of action that happens between the power transition starts and the there's a great power war. And actually, in that transition, hegemony tends to unravel, the order unravels long before, often, or can unravel before you get to the question at all whether there's going to be a war. And there are a set of mechanisms by which it unravels. There are a set of processes by which it unravels that we have sort of, that both kind of are in the headlines and are things that we pull from various work we've done on historical periods, right? One is that you get transnational contention against the order, right? You get movements that start to question the basis of the order and start to agitate against it. And those movements often are operating within the core of the order, right? And the reason you get that is in part because relative decline sours people on the model of the hegemon, that the existence of rising chowards provides alternate models. It can mean that there's actually funding and ideological alliances. And this is what's happening right now with Russia, right, and with the transnational right. Right, the neo-fascist movements and the post-fascist movements. There's also some of that going on in a very different way with Chinese soft power building, Confucius Institutes, all that sort of stuff, where the Chinese are trying to generate that kind of capital. Secondly, you get a situation in which a lot of the nuts and bolts of the way order is held up is by basic things like it's aid and bargain, security assistance, security commitments, it's trading relationships, economic relationships, essentially things where the hegemon is giving certain kinds of goods to other states in return for their compliance with its order preferences. And some of those good, actually the way it's giving those goods, some of the ways it's actually doing development or doing open trade are in fact order enforcing, are actually the order themselves, right? And so there's a very standard story this starts to become an issue in the mid-2000s where people start saying, well, wait a minute, there's all this Chinese aid floating around. They don't seem to care about democracy. They don't seem to care about human rights. They don't seem to care about corruption. Moshe Naim called this rogue aid, which starts to carve out that order. And I think even more than carving out that order, because it gives states that were beforehand dependent upon Western aid exit options, it changes the bargaining leverage in those relationships. And so you can get this sort of incremental alterations in international order out of these very small-scale state-by-state decisions that really can kind of transform its nuts and bolts, transform what's going on long before we even kind of think about the U.S. as being, you know, militarily challenged. The third mechanism is the kind of a top-down version of that. It's the actual states that might be revisionist, acting revisionistly, challenging the United States, building alternative orders. So China's One Belt, One Road initiative. Russia's more limited attempts to do this through kind of wedging apart NATO or supporting the Assad regime in Syria. And not all of these things actually are order challenging, but they can be. And what we see right now is that all of these things are actually in positive feedback loop right now. Right, so they're all bootstrapping on each other in a way that is maybe more accelerated than we see in prior transitions. And then the big outlier, the big wild card in this, is that all of these things are happening without Trump, right? And Trump enters into an environment where all of these dynamics have been happening, and enters into it both as somebody who wants to disrupt the order from within the hegemon in a way that we don't see historically. And we certainly don't see seizing the reins of power historically very often. It does happen. But also, he's an accelerant in that regard. And the other strange thing about Trump is that in some respects, he's a product of this anti-order contention. So it's not usual that it gets captured. That you usually expect these things to be happening outside of the guarantor of the order, right? And historically, if you want to think about this, you know, the fascist movements were successful outside of the core liberal states. The fact that they're having success in the core liberal states now is unusual, and it means that in a sense there is no actor right now where the heads of state have both the will and the capacity to navigate this game effectively. I mean, the UK has completely taken itself out with Brexit, right, with a little bit of assistance, as we now know, from Russia, etc. So that's what we sort of think is going on, and that's the kind of core argument of the book, if that makes sense. And I think that's why we should care a lot, progressives should care a lot about Russia, because even if you don't like, or what's going on, because even if you don't like liberal order, you have to ask yourself, you know, do we like neo-fascist order more? And I'm not sure that we should.
Right. I mean, let's set aside this question of what a neo-fascist order or sort of alternative orders might look like. And right now, perhaps discuss a little bit more in terms of, you know, the actual impact on American foreign policy and how American foreign policy is either furthering or avoiding certain of the outcomes that we are talking about here.
And let me put two ways that this hooks up to foreign policy, neither of which come from me. They're all derived from other people. The first is that this kind of instability in American political institutions is unusual in the post-Cold War period, and it's to some degree unusual. It's essentially been unusual since the United States emerged as an international power. We haven't seen this kind of these levels of polarization and these levels of flips, right? So we haven't seen situations generally where if you change the party, you get radical changes in U.S. foreign policy, or at least you get rhetoric about radical changes in U.S. foreign policy. So there are actually fairly worrisome implications about these domestic political trends, all these wave elections, all these sort of radicalized bases. If you think that the United States needs to kind of maintain a steady within bounds range of policy commitments in order to navigate being an in decline sole superpower, right? Or maybe not even a sole superpower anymore. Secondly, it's made it, and this is something that a number of people have picked up with Paul Musgrave, who I talked about earlier, it's made it impossible for the U.S. to make new big international commitments. I mean, you even treaties that should have been non-controversial, right? America, you know, the Disabilities Treaty and things like that, they went down because of partisan, you know, narrow partisan opposition in the Senate. That's extremely worrying, because if you look at what Trump's talking about, what people like us in the progressive left are talking about, even we're talking about, to various degrees, the notion that the United States needs to form new bargains, right? How do you do those new bargains if you can't get a treaty ratified, right? If and we saw the consequences of that with the pullout of the joint, of the Iran deal. We saw the pullout of the JCPOA was what I was trying to say. We saw the pullout of the climate agreement, and whether or not you like
the TPP is the big one.
Right?
I mean, it is in a lot of ways bigger than JCPOA.
You know, the TPP. Yeah, and the TTP is something that I think there's going to be a lot of hard discussion about what the Trans-Pacific Partnership means for the progressive left, and the pullout and the implications of the pullout mean for the progressive left, who very much opposed the treaty but are going to have to deal with figuring out what the United States does now in a way that Trump is just not interested in.
Right. I mean, the TPP is one of these, I wouldn't say rare, but unusual points of dissensus among the front pagers at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, where sort of there are sort of significantly different opinions on its value. And I think probably maybe at some point we could productively tease those out and have, say, Loomis or perhaps some of the others on here to talk more specifically about the TPP. But that said, I want to drag you a bit in this direction to thinking about well, I want to drag, since most of our readers are, most of the listeners are blog readers, how is the blog sort of really playing into this process? And I mean, obviously you're creating blog posts and you're generating comments, and so how is this playing into the process of creating this book that you and Alex are working on?
So, I mean, I think, you know, obviously I've been writing this series at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, which is really an attempt to jumpstart a book, and what I've said fairly explicitly is that it turns out that I can write blog posts and I can write academic articles, but when I try to write more blog-like academic articles, I can't do it. So I figured I might as well just blog post my way through this theory chapter, which is the roughest chapter because it's the chapter that needs to be comprehensible, not just to advanced PhD students and to other academics. And in fact, in some respects, the book is not a book about liberal order. I mean, the fact is that we have a something in a nebulous sense, a liberal order, and so it's about contemporary international order. But it's been very clear that the debate about liberal order is heating up, and the debate about and questions of liberal order are pretty hard to escape if you talk about American-led hegemony and its fate. So that's been kind of interesting. I will say to the LGM readers, the feedback in the comments has been really excellent, and has really helped my thinking about this. So I really appreciate that.
Right. No, I mean, I found, unsurprisingly, I found the post very, very interesting, I guess. And so what I've been doing recently is, listening to, and I've actually forced my daughters to do the same thing. I've been listening to History of the Peloponnesian War, which is just fantastically the intellectual experience of listening to History of the Peloponnesian War is fantastically different than reading it off the page, right? I mean, it's remarkably different, and almost intentionally so, right? Because I mean, Thucydides is writing for an audience that a large part of his audience is going to be non-literate, and so his book is going to be read as much as it, or is going to be read out loud as much as it's read. And one other thing that struck me is something that you talked about in one of your first posts, or it was the first or the second post, which was that an empire is never a single kind of arrangement, right? That it's a whole various set of different arrangements that are made in different parts of the globe, right? And so, and you make this point with respect to the British Empire, but it's also true of the American Empire, right? That we think of the U.S.-led global international order as consisting of the, you know, of North America, Western Europe, and then the most industrialized parts of Northeast Asia. But the ways in which the United States manages these three elements of this global order are radically different, right? I mean, there is nothing like NATO in Northeast Asia, and yet Northeast Asia is one of the pillars of this international order, right? And that's very evocative, sort of listening to Thucydides describe what the Athenian Empire is, because the relation, and sort of almost literally, as each new Athenian ally explains why they're rebelling, they explain their own specific set of interactions with Athens, and they're all different, right? They are all in a different set and a different kind of interactions that give them a particular reason to rebel. And so anyway, listening to that this morning was actually very evocative of the post that you were writing on, that I just then read on hegemony, and on how hegemony has these different facets. And sort of in this sense, it's always kind of been true, whether we're talking about the liberal empire today or sort of Athens's attempt at an empire in its own period.
What's interesting about this is that the argument that the United States has really a lot of different kinds of relationships in the security and the economic realm and, you know, diplomatic realm, et cetera, has been picked up recently by critics of the very notion of the liberal order, right? So, you know, Paul Stanelin has that nice piece at Lawfare where he says, you know, it doesn't really clear that there's any such thing as the liberal order, and look, in exactly what you said, Northeast Asia, that's a series of bilateral hub and spokes. If you go over to Western Europe, it's NATO. If you go over to the Middle East, it's more, I mean, he doesn't say this outright, but it's more like informal empire in some ways, even than the East Asian system, which is structurally like informal empire, but isn't quite as asymmetric as you often experience, at least now, right? It was for much of the Cold War. It's still pretty asymmetric. And then there's a tendency to say, well, okay, well, it's because it's this patchwork, it doesn't make sense to talk about liberal order. And there are kind of two concerns that I have with that. One is that it confuses form with content, right? It confuses the sort of ways in which you structure your hegemonic or your leadership relationships, your relationships with the particular content that they have. And then it also assumes that that content itself has to be uniform across time and space in order for there to be something called a liberal order. The other thing it does, and I didn't explain this very well in the post, but I said, you know, there's a risk of missing the forest for the trees in that old cliche, is that when we talk about that, we tend to kind of we tend to hive off each of those regions and relationships, right? So we say, okay, well, over in Northeast Asia, it's a bilateral hub and spoke system, right? With Japan and Korea, used to be much more Taiwan, but, you know, as kind of the anchors of this relationship. If we go over to Europe, it's NATO. Then we have this other thing called the Five Eyes, and we have the kind of the Australia, U.S., the sort of settler colony Anglosphere, as it were, set of cooperation that's kind of embedded but also different from that. You go over to, you know, India, and it's, we don't, you know, that's a kind of, there's kind of India playing the U.S. and Russia off against each other. You kind of do this whole game. And you say, okay, well, these are all really different, so therefore, you know, there's no such thing as the order, et cetera. But actually, all of these things are, if you scale them up, right, if you were to take them as like a picture of various kinds of connections between the United States, right, as, you know, so over here it's multilateral, over here it's bilateral, you would actually have a system composed of different kinds of relationships. And that system as an aggregate is also pretty important. And so the United States relationship with Japan is not something completely autonomous from the United States relationship with NATO. It's part of this overarching system. And that's why I think the British Empire example is so useful, John Darwin's work on the British world system, because the British Empire, again, which we think of now as a monolith, looked like that, right? It had to be managed as a complex system, with parts that were sometimes in conflict with one another or in tension with one another. It had to be jury-rigged and kludged together. You know, there's that old, you know, founded in a fit of absent-mindedness thing about the British Empire, which isn't quite right, but it does get at this sort of, this very, you know, kind of, this very kind of patchwork, jury-rigged kind of thing. And so that's what I kind of worry about, is that we is not only that we don't see different kinds of liberalism, and think there's kind of one way of doing liberal order, but that we also don't recognize that there is a system of management, of hegemonic management, that is locally adapted. If that makes any sense.
No, it makes it. Well, I mean, that part makes complete sense to me. If it's possible, I want to drag back to another point that you made in the first post, which is particularly of interest to me because I've done some thinking along the same lines, which was this sort of the standard way that international relations scholars have thought about the relationship between polarity, which is a sort of a set of what you might call brute facts about the world that have to do with military power and economic power, and hegemony, which is much less of a brute fact, right? Hegemony is much, we grant is much more of a social construct than economic or military power, has been that hegemony results from some combination of these brute facts of military and, so it's military power plus economic power plus, you know, the willingness to do something with those, right? And what you suggested here, which I thought was very interesting, was that in some sense, this brute fact of military supremacy is actually the result of hegemony, right? And it's the result of hegemony in a few different ways, right? And so one of the ways you talk about it is that, you know, what hegemony does is it allows countries like Japan and Germany, or if not allows, then induces countries like Japan and Germany and Britain and the UK, or Britain and France and so forth, to not develop challenging military capabilities, right? And it induces even other potential challengers like China, right? And, you know, the question of whether does China not spend as much on military as it could because the U.S. military is so overwhelming? Well, you know, there's at least there's a plausible story there. But anyway, what hegemony does is it sort of extends this gap between military supremacy and economic supremacy, where in economically, the world has been multipolar for a very long time. Militarily, it's been unipolar, and for some reason, it's been unipolar because of American hegemony. And then there are a couple other things you could talk about, which I think we could expand upon, that sort of on the one side, what hegemony helps to do is to give the United States military access to the globe, which no other country in the world can even conceivably think to enjoy, which even the Soviet Union could not enjoy at reasonable cost during its most powerful military period. It gives the United States a tremendous amount of experience in working in different parts of the world, which no other country can really enjoy. And also, and this is something that I've been working a little bit on lately, sort of the creation of the global liberal international order also gave the United States the fruits of technological specialization for its own military machine, which, again, the Soviet Union, which had a much more autarkic model, was never really able to enjoy. So in a sense, hegemony and the hegemonic system of trade and so forth that the United States established fed into this military dominance.
Right, and harkens back to a very old argument, which is whether hegemony pays for itself. Right? Because one of the standard stories about how hegemons collapse is strategic overextension. The idea is that they overinvest in military security in order to maintain order, particularly on the periphery, to enforce their writ. And they then underinvest domestically, or they distort their economy, or they break the political coalition in favor of engaging in hegemony, although that story is not really the story that gets emphasized, and I think that's actually a problem. The story that gets emphasized tends to just be they let their domestic economy atrophy, they have all these unproductive investments, and that exacerbates uneven growth that might cause rising challengers. So this is an old debate, does hegemony pay for itself? But I think to some, and then the other people say, well, no, because hegemony lets you lock in all these advantages, and look in the examples in the U.S. include dollarization of the oil markets, dollarization of reserve currency, things that the U.S. actually actively did after the collapse of Bretton Woods to maintain power. And you have people like Carlin Orloff and Bill Wolforth and Steve Brooks who say, you know, yeah, actually there are positive returns from hegemony. I actually think that debate's, it's too mechanistic, right? The question is not, you know, in the final tally, are there increasing returns or decreasing returns for hegemony? The question is what happens as a result of hegemony run a particular way. So the U.S. may still be getting a bad deal versus what it would get if we weren't engaged in hegemony for its own citizens. That might be true, But I think it's still undeniable that it has these kinds of effects you're talking
well,
about.
Well, I mean, and you hinted at this in one of the due posts where you talked about sort of part of the problem for the United States is that our domestic institutions remain unsuited, and our domestic coalitions remain unsuited to whether hegemony is a good or a bad thing for the United States. Our current domestic situation makes it in some ways untenable, right? And this goes back to something we talked about earlier, where you're seeing these radical tacks in foreign policy by the U.S. government. That in the same way that we can say, what we could do is we could say that whether or not hegemony is a net benefit to the United States is in a sense an irrelevant question, right? Because it's the same kind of question, well, is free trade a net on balance a benefit to the United States or a benefit to any given country, right? And, you know, the more we talk about that, the more it becomes that, well, sure, depending on a particular configuration of domestic institutions that are able to share those gains in a relatively equitable manner and then proceed sensibly from there, right? But if you don't have those kinds of domestic institutions, then whether hegemony is good or not good for the United States becomes a secondary question to how the domestic institutions are filtering hegemony, right? Whatever benefits there may be, if the Athenian people are not receiving them, then they're sort of largely irrelevant to the body politic of Athens.
Right. And actually, you know, it would be good to shout out to Thomas Oatley's arguments here, because, you know, as I referenced in the post, he has a book where he argues that boom and bust cycles that we've experienced now are at root a consequence of the way that we've done hegemony, which is to deficit finance military spending. And when we do big deficit financing, this draws in all this investment. It creates a network. It makes the U.S. really central in the global financial network because we're sort of soaking up investment into our debt. It has other kinds of effects that then produce the boom and bust cycle. So he says that, you know, the things that we've seen over the last 20 years, 25 years, 30 years are actually endogenous to the way we've done hegemony. So that's, I think, a good one of the ways that you could take this. But, you know, fundamentally what I think, which is that the United States does not have a political coalition for the domestic bargain it would need. I don't think it can maintain hegemony forever, and I don't think, in fact, even now when we talk about maintaining the American system, we're talking about maintaining the U.S., you know, dominating the globe. There are big power shifts that are happening. But I'm talking about sort of what you would need to maintain a kind of sphere of security that, you know, a lot of us think would benefit the United States. And that coalition doesn't exist because the people who would like to be more assertive and more aggressive in foreign policy and want to spend overspend on the military for that are also the people who want to cut taxes and essentially pursue policies that redistribute income upwards.
Right,
which erode the sort of social compact, which makes people feel that they're, you know, even though they don't feel directly, I'm getting something out of this, but makes them feel like they have the kinds of basic economic security they would expect to get in exchange for U.S. leadership. And on the other hand, you don't have really yet a progressive national greatness agenda, but you could cobble it together out of the proposals to, you know, really capture a lot of the surplus to really tax more. And you wouldn't just be able to tax the upper classes. You'd have to tax throughout society more to build sort of social democratic institutions that would then, I think, actually be the foundation for not only that compact of U.S. liberal order, but also then have these particularly important effects of keeping U.S. human capital investment up, keep investment spending up, keeping U.S. infrastructure spending up, sort of maintaining the engine of U.S. military and economic position.
Right. So, I mean, sort of on that line, I wanted to extend a little bit off. So in the second post, you dealt a little bit with, and so I think that as an institution, many people criticize Lawyers Guns and Money for being more focused on sort of leftist critiques of these kinds of questions than we are on sort of the much larger and much broader sort of right-wing critiques, right? We are sometimes accused of punching left, right? Which I think is a horrible construct. I hate the way that kind of phrasing works. But I mean, and there was a particularly evocative tweet that I saw the other day, which was something along the lines, and this was a very punch lefty sort of tweet. It was like, if you really hate the hypocritical liberal order that exists now, you're really not going to love the sincere illiberal order that is being established in its place, right? Which is, I think, certainly true, but not nearly as productive as a response to sort of left critiques of U.S. hegemony that one could possibly have. Now, I think...
I said that in the post, yeah. So I'm guilty.
Yeah. So, how much of this is going to... How much do you plan to sort of answer these left critiques of sort of the liberal international order?
Well, I think the critical thing from my perspective, and, you know, I am by nature a conflicted person, is I think a lot of the left critiques are true. Right? I mean, how can you look at the U.S. record of covert and overt foreign-imposed regime change and say, this was a great thing, right? Overthrowing our bends, that worked out really well for the Guatemalan people. How can you look at Iraq, right, and say, oh, yeah, you know, yes, let's forcibly promote democracy. That's a great idea, right? Which in Iraq is probably the defining, one of the really truly defining moments of post-92 American hegemony. And probably we're going to, you know, historians are going to look back and say it's the inflection point, right, for it all going down. So that's exactly right. I mean, you can't argue with that. That left-wing critique is correct. It's also correct that the United States does pursue its national interest at the expense of other people. That the really kind of abstract talk about the wonders of the American-led liberal order, it's a fantasy, right? But it's also a set of, you know, political rhetoric in the same way that talking about the wonders of the free market or the wonders of socialism is a set of political rhetoric that oversimplifies things. You know, there's that tweet by Haas where he started talking about, you know, the Westphalian order and respect for sovereignty and how the Russians had abrogated that by meddling in our election, and where everybody, you know, everybody left, right, and center was just like, what are you talking about, right? You know, there's rhetoric, and then there's a complete lack of self-reflection. So my position has always been that that the argument is really about this. It's whether you think that putting a more sort of left progressives or a center-left progressive coalition that checked some of the impulses we don't like about particularly militarization of foreign policy or the national security state is better than the alternatives. And I think it's not. But I think that more broadly, I misarticulated this. The debate really comes down to, and you see this in our own comment threads, right, between people who have sincerely held and I think powerful positions, which is one position says we just need to take away America's toys, right? The United States record is so bad if you give the United States its liberal order, whatever that might be, it will do things that are horrific, right? And people who say, which is where I lean, would say, well, yeah, the U.S. does some pretty bad shit, and what we ought to do is not do it. And there's nothing intrinsic about some of these capabilities that force us to do it, although there are national security state problems that really need to be addressed,
right,
and where left-wing critiques ought to be taken up very seriously and ought to be implemented. So I think that the people who a broad rush of the people who say you just got to take the toys away are sincere, right? And I think they have good empirical evidence on their side. What I have maintained is that not only is the reformist position better because I think you can do it, but also because you are giving up there is a counterfactual question of what does the alternative look like? And the way that I've made this quite simply is to say, if you don't like U.S. empire, what do you see Russian or Chinese empire? Right. There's nothing, just as there's no special sauce in American character that means that everything the United States does is good and exceptional, there sure as heck is no special sauce in American imperialism that makes it worse than what other imperial powers have pursued. And I don't want to play the game of, well, look at all the good stuff we did and look at the bad stuff we did, and say, well, the good stuff we did outweighs. I don't know. I mean, that's a question of who you are, right? I don't think that the world is better for indigenous Guatemalans because of the U.S., you know, activity in Central America, and you just can't make that argument. There, a lot of people died and are living in a very violent, horrific environment, which is all the United States. So what does it mean to say on balance it's good for the Guatemalans? On the other hand, what does it mean to say that on balance it's bad, right, if you're the Germans, right, or if you're the Japanese, right, or if you're the Koreans? Koreans, interesting too, because then you go back to the U.S. support of, you know, authoritarianism in Korea, So, I mean, ultimately, where it comes down to, I think, is that we spend a lot of time looking backwards, right? And not enough time thinking about what would we like world order to look like on the progressive left. And what does that mean for the U.S.?
Right. I mean, I think that there's also – there's a, I come back to this because occasionally you'll see from sort of critics on the progressive left, and especially because human rights and democracy have been – and especially human rights have the language of human rights was appropriated in very effective ways in the 1990s and the 2000s by the neocon right, right? You know, to the extent that even the suffering of Iraqi children – under the sanctions regime, was appropriated by the neocon right in service of an imperialist war against Iraq, right? But it was appropriated very effectively, right? And sort of human rights has been a part of sort of the American hegemonic project for as long as there's been one, but it's always been a complicated and contradictory part. And so sometimes you will see arguments along the lines of, well, everyone knows that the United States really doesn't care about human rights, that human rights are basically irrelevant to American foreign policy, which is, if you, and I'm sure you do, if you know people who work in the State Department, if you know people who work in the all of the different arms of the U.S. government, is an absurd claim, right? I mean, that there are people who devote their lives to the extension of what almost everyone agrees are laudable human rights and laudable development goals, right? And these people, if you work with them, they'll tell you that there are consequential differences between different presidential administrations and how they think about these things, right? So that the way the Obama administration approached questions of human rights and social justice and development and so forth was dramatically different than the Bush administration did, and was certainly dramatically different than the Trump administration did, right? And that in itself suggests that there is promise in this reformist project, right? Right? If sometimes we do things right, then, you know, try to create the conditions under which we do things right more often, right? Apart from this set of questions about whether on balance things have been good or bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I think this comes back to there is two. I don't want to say, every time I say this, I get the hives, right? Because what does it mean to focus too much on American wars? But there is certainly a really strong emphasis on two things on further left critiques, because, you know, we're on the left, right? One of which is there's a lot of focus on militarization of foreign policy. And the other one of which is that there's a lot of focus on American support for autocratic regimes who are friendly to the United States. And I think we can agree that militarization is bad. Right, that the U.S. foreign policy is militarized, and what we want to do is we want to, on the human rights front, be focusing on the naming and shaming tools and on the development aid tools, and that's going to get harder. By the way, like we're talking about an environment where all of those tools are going to be less effective over time, right? Because of the infusion of non-U.S. non-European aid into the environment, and non-U.S. and European trade into the environment. Secondly, on the American Start for Autocracies front, you know, that's kind of case by case, right? It is a little bit weird to say the United States shouldn't get involved in the sovereign affairs of other countries because it's always a bad thing, and then to scream about the United States having sort of realist alliances with autocracies, because, in fact, if you shouldn't get involved in the sovereign affairs of other states, then, you know, you should be having situational alliances that serve your immediate interests. That's kind of the alternative. But I think certainly one of the things the progressive needs to, you know, that a progressive foreign policy does is revisit that. And I think the good example of this is the progressive push on Yemen, which has been stalled out, but, you know, that the United States really shouldn't be basically fighting a proxy war that's with these enormous humanitarian costs that are essentially interventions in the Saudi-Iranian struggle for Gulf hegemony. So I think that it's not a tally sheet, right? It's what are the things that we do right, and should we be doing more of those? And what are the things that we do wrong, and should we be doing less of those? Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense to me. I think that we are probably near the close of what we can usefully talk about in this particular podcast. So, but I think that we should probably over the course of the future revisit some of these topics, especially since we have lots of free space on this podcast. So,
with that in mind, this is Robert Farley signing out. Thank you, LGM readers.
Well, thanks for listening. This is Dan Nexon signing off.